Let's take our Bibles and turn to the book of Ecclesiastes. We'll be looking at the end of chapter 2 this morning. And I'm speaking from memory, and it's memory from a long time ago. But I think that, as I recall, when one of the things that I was taught when we learned autonomy of the church was a passage in Titus. And you might remember there that Paul tells Titus that one of the reasons he left him in Crete was that he should set things in order that are wanting. And then it says, ordain elders in every city. And the inference might be that Paul told Titus to pick people to be an elder or pastor in each city. And I don't know all the language and all of that, but I was taught that when you read that, the language that it was given to us in implies or makes clear that those in the cities where they were would be the ones ordaining. So it was something like, for this cause left I thee in Crete, that thou shouldest set in order the things that are wanting, and they should ordain elders in every city. So each city would ordain themselves elders. So because that passage there kind of sounds like a hierarchy. And so to understand it, if we believe that there's not a hierarchy, we need to understand how this verse fits in. And like I say, that was 25 years ago when I had that class, and I didn't. He studied for that, but it came to mind when he brought it up, and I thought I would point it out. Anyway, we're looking in Ecclesiastes this summer, and Book of Ecclesiastes, like all the books of poetry, are a little bit harder to understand. Two summers ago, we looked through Job, and you remember that Job is kind of biographical, and then there's these long segments of speaking, and actually, Job has terrible consequences come upon him, and he despairs even of life. He says, God would take my life, or I wish I hadn't even been born, and we recognize when Job says that there's a reason he said that. He was under severe problems and problems that weren't his. He didn't bring them on himself. In fact, God says that Job was a righteous man, and then in the end we see that he was again. And so we see that even righteous men come into troubles, and they might even say things that we should be careful. I remember saying this all summer long. We should be careful not to cast judgment on Job, because he didn't have the book of Job to teach him. Do you remember me saying that? Okay, we learn to endure trials because Job is an example for us to help with that. Elijah, after the fire came down and he slew all the prophets of Baal and prophets of the grove, and then he ran off into the wilderness. Jezebel told him that he was going to be just like one of her prophets by the end of the day or something like that. And he left, and he despaired of his life. He said, take my life. I'm the only one left. He'd been working and working, and nobody else was standing for the Lord. That's what he thought. Of course, God came to him and strengthened him, told him there's 7,000 that haven't bowed the knee to Baal. But here's Elijah, a man who stood before the Lord, who spoke for the Lord. We see him referred to over and over again in the New Testament. In fact, it's the spirit of Elijah, or even Elijah, is promised that he would come before the Messiah. Of course, John the Baptist filled that position in a certain sense. But Elijah is a great man of God, and he despaired of his life. So we have these illustrations of people given to us to learn from them. And we're going to see today that the preacher in Ecclesiastes says, I hated life. I looked around, and it was empty, and I hated it. It made me mad. So as we've begun looking through Ecclesiastes, it's written by the preacher. And what does a preacher do? he gives a sermon. And so Ecclesiastes is basically a big sermon, and but it's a sermon that approaches, is the approach of the sermon is kind of backwards to the way we hear most sermons. Most of the time we hear a preacher get up and say, I'm going to preach on this, and tells us what we should believe, what we should understand, and then he gives reasons to support it. And the preacher here in Ecclesiastes kind of goes the other way around. He says, look at what it's like out there, and then he says, is this the answer? Is this the answer? Is this the answer? And finally at the end he says, well, no, this. He finally concludes at the end and tells us what the answer is. So his text, as we pointed out 2 weeks ago, is verses 2 through 11 of chapter 1 is his text, and he looks around and sees emptiness. You look for meaning in life around you. You look for something. Is there any profit under the sun? You look for a reason to live in this place or in that place, and you find that if that's where you look, life is empty. And I'm saying it that way on purpose because that's what most people do. They look in different places and find that life is empty. And then last week we looked at looking at wisdom, looking at increasing knowledge. And if you look to wisdom and you look to knowledge, like if I just know more, then I'll know the meaning of life. And you find that that's empty. The more you know, you find out that everything, that in every place, in every occupation, in every way of life, it's the same emptiness as it was in yours. And so you find out more and you find out it's the same. He that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. And then you look to pleasures. You say, well, there's so many things in the world that can give me happiness and pleasure. I'm going to just, that's where there would be meaning. And you can look in so many different areas, into humor, into even the joy or the pleasure that we get from working, from accomplishments, and all of those things, while they do give pleasure, they don't fulfill. They don't fill. And so if you're looking, so the preacher is showing us that if you look for meaning in life, if you look for a reason to live in pleasure, you won't be fulfilled. You will have a good time while it takes place or while you're in the midst of it, but then it ends, and when it ends, there's nothing lasting that sticks with you afterward. And so he said that about wisdom. Wisdom is empty if that's all there is to life. Pleasure and frivolity, fun, is empty if that's all there is to life. But before he moves on, he says, before we trash both of those, let's see if one is better than the other. And so we can pick up his sermon in verse 12 of chapter 2. And I'm going to read through and maybe comment along the way and then try to bring it together. In verse 12 of Ecclesiastes 2, it says, "And I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly." So he's looking at all of at both of them together. "Wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do that cometh after the king? Even that which hath already been done," or "which hath been already done. Then I saw that wisdom excelleth folly as far as light excelleth darkness." So he's giving us his conclusion right at the top, and then he's going to give us different things that he thought about along the way. But he says, wisdom, even though wisdom isn't the answer, it's way better than pleasures. Okay? It excels folly as far as light excelleth darkness. There's like no comparison. The wise man's eyes are in his head, okay? But the fool walketh in darkness. And I myself perceived also that one event happeneth to them all. Okay, so he says, the wise man has his eyes in his head, he sees things. The fool, he's walking or he's wandering around darkness, but one event, you know, if there's a tornado, it wipes out the wise man's house and the fool's house. One event happeneth to them all. Then I said in my heart, verse 15, as it happeneth to the fool, so it happeneth even unto me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart that this also is vanity. Okay? You're looking around and you see somebody is wise, somebody is foolish, but chance or whatever you want to say, the rain falls on the just and the unjust, the winds blow, things happen to everybody, and say, well, that's not right. That's empty. There's something wrong with that. Verse 16, for there's no remembrance of the wise more than of the fool forever. Here's somebody who's wise and somebody that's fool, and the wise man, you know, he does something and you'd think he would be remembered for that. But no, years go by and no one remembers him, just like they don't remember the fool. In fact, he gives an illustration, and we'll get to it again, but he gives an illustration of a wise man that saved a whole city. But the people didn't remember all the works that he did. That's in chapter 9. There's no remembrance, seeing that which now is, in the days to come, shall be forgotten. And how dieth the wise man? Same way as the fool. It appears. Therefore, I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and vexation of spirit. I'm going to try to explain this understanding as we once we finish, but he's looking at life, and he says, this is not right. It's all vanity. It's all vexation of spirit. It's not right. And I will just say, each of us have looked around at life. We may have been at a funeral of a child, and said, this isn't right. Why didn't, if you, and there are some people here that have, if you've had to bury your own child, that's not right. The old man should be dying, not the child. I wasn't even able to be there, but Darcel McCoy's funeral. Okay, he died. There's an accident. Who lives? The drunk. The drunk lives, and the preacher dies. It makes you hate life. It says, this is not right. This is not the way it should be. So I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me. All is vanity and vexation of spirit. Yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. And who knows, who knoweth, whether he shall be a wise man or a fool. Yet shall he have rule over all my labor wherein I have labored, and wherever I have shown myself wise under the sun. This is also vanity. It reminds me, I kind of like technology a little bit, and this verse right here reminds me of Apple, the company Apple. And maybe you're not familiar with that, but a man, Steve Jobs, probably not a Christian, but he worked a certain way, and he brought Apple to be a premier company. But then he died. And the person that came after him, if you follow technology and news, people are always, for a long time, saying, well, that's not what Steve Jobs would do. That's not what Steve Jobs would do. Okay, well, this guy is not Steve Jobs. But Steve Jobs can't have any say over what's going to happen to his everything that he's worked for after he dies. And that's a big example, but the same's true with us. You can try to prepare a work for someone else, but when you're gone, you're not going to, I mean, preacher, even with this church, he's worked for 43 years. He's handed it off, in a certain sense, to Pastor Dameron. And he's still around, but once he leaves, he won't have any influence over what happens with this church. Not when he's dead. That's not right. After all those years of work, that's kind of the idea that we see here. Therefore, verse 20, therefore I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is in wisdom and in knowledge and in equity, yet to a man that hath not labored therein shall he leave it for his portion. This also is vanity and a great evil. And evil there is not something like, there's about five definitions of evil. And this evil is not like sin type evil. It's just, it's a mishap. It's, you know, something happens that shouldn't happen. So that's the sense of the evil there. For what hath man of all his labor and of the vexation of his heart, wherein he had labored under the sun? For all his days are sorrows and his travail grief. Yea, his heart taketh not rest in the night. This is also vanity. There's nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw, that it was from the hand of God. For who can eat, or who else can hasten hereunto more than I? For God giveth to a man that is good in his sight wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner he giveth travail to gather and to heap up, that he may give to him that is good before God. This also is vanity and vexation of spirit. Now, I want to try to give an illustration that hopefully will help us understand some of what's going on here. Some of you have been involved in the Empowered Youth meetings. Some of you have come on Thursday night early enough to see the madness. And I use that term on purpose, the madness that is in here. There's some type of a board up here, and there's questions being asked, and it's just craziness. It's mad. It's maddening. It's especially maddening to us if we were going to be a part of it, because you've seen it. You answer the question right, and you get to take one step on the board. And it's the hardest question that's been asked all week long. Right? Somebody else answers a question like, what is your name? Or what is your youth pastor's name? And they get to take 30 steps. It's not fair. It's not right. It's maddening. It's crazy. And for sure, we don't want life to be that way. We don't mind. We can handle it if it's a game. It's a bunch of teenagers. But some of us wouldn't even be able to. I mean, you wouldn't invite people over to your house to play a game like that, because it would just make you mad. Because it's not right. Right? It's not right. Sometimes we don't want life to be that way. But sometimes it is, isn't it? Really, sometimes life is that way. Sometimes people are that way. Sometimes people cheat and they get away with it. Sometimes people, it doesn't make sense. Sometimes the circumstances appear as if things are not happening right and people are getting away with it. Why does life sometimes appear like the world is crazy? The answer should be obvious to us. Why is life so frustrating? Because we're not in Eden. This is not the way it was created to be. It's the way it is. We're not perfect. And the world is not perfect. God is perfect, but it's not perfect. So how should we respond to that? How should we respond to that? That issue is, that illustration is a little bit crazy. Let's take one that's maybe a little more realistic and you might even face sometime. Or you could make parallels easier. Let's just imagine that you are the coach of a basketball team. Ah, exactly. I've got it right in my mind. Pastor Dameron is the coach of the college basketball team, and he goes to the Indiana State Prison because they have a basketball team there. And you go in, and I don't know, I've never been there. Some of you probably have. And you go there, and you're playing against the prisoners. And the referees are prisoners, and it just seems like the game is kind of rigged. The game is kind of rigged, and there's nothing you can do, okay? You have three choices, and All three of them are in this passage. You could, you know, they're cheating and getting away with it. So you could cheat yourself and see if you can get away with it. Okay? You could just go, you say, this is maddening. I'm going to join in with the madness. You could say, I give up. I'm not going to be a part of this. And that would be like verse 20. I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. So you could abandon yourself and join in with it. You could say, I'm not going to have a part of it. You could just give up. Or you could do what's right. And wisdom is what's right. And that's kind of the picture that we get here. Wisdom far excels folly. If you join in with the madness, what is there in the game? It's all madness. Okay? If you give up, what is there in the game? It's all madness. If you do what's right, at least there's a little bit of sanity there because you are doing what's right. And that's what we should see here. When we look at life, it's not always the way we think it should be, but if we're choosing between wisdom and folly, don't go with folly. Choose wisdom. Wisdom far excels folly. And for that, reminds me of something that Mr. Haiti always used to tell me. I might be teasing him about his age or something like that, and he would say to me, well, just keep living. Just keep living. Well, in another sense, with a better perspective than that, when we look at the world around us, and it's not the way that we think it should be, we have to say, well, this is not the way God created things, but we fell. His creation fell, and it's not right, but I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to join in. I'm just going to keep living. Keep doing what is right. And that's in his first conclusion, we'll say, that we see is there in verse 24. There's nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw that was from the hand of God. God does give good for labor. He gives us food and drink to enjoy. Now, this is in contrast with just giving yourself to food pleasures, but we should eat, drink, and allow our soul to enjoy good in our labor. This is from the hand of God. For who can eat, or who else can hasten hereunto more than I? For God, and this is important, God giveth to a man that is good in his sight wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner he giveth travail to gather and to heap up, that he may give it to him that is good before God. So after this looking at life and seeing that things aren't right, he doesn't say, well, I'm just going to forget it all and join in with it. He says, no, it's best if I do what's right. The man that is good in God's sight receives wisdom and knowledge, and the sinner, he gets trouble. Now, he said before, it looks like this sinner got something good and this other person got trouble. But here in the conclusion, this first conclusion, he says, yeah, but in the big picture, in the end, the man that does right, God blesses, and the sinner, God gives trouble, and even the things that he works on, he heaps up so that God can give it to the person that is good. Do you remember the parable of the talents, the one foolish man? What did Jesus say to do with his talent? He said, take it from him and give it to the man who has 10 talents. This is a similar idea right here. That those that please God, he blesses, and those that do not, he curses. And he takes even what they have to give to those that he wants to. So we should enjoy the good of our labor that is from God. God gives that. God gives to those that are good. God takes from the sinner. God gives the sinner trouble. And this is a part of life. He uses, in one sense, God uses the emptiness of life to accomplish his means. And because we're all sinners, sometimes we get what we don't think we should deserve, and it makes life seem meaningless. But we shouldn't just we shouldn't end with a meaningless life. We should see what that teaches us. And the preacher is not despairing of life. He says, I look at life and it makes me angry. I hate it, but I come to this conclusion, and he comes to the right conclusion. And he comes further and stronger into that conclusion as we proceed through the book. But let's just remember that for now and let that form your thinking as you read through it, that life around us isn't right. It's not the Garden of Eden anymore. It's imperfect and it's full of trouble. But that doesn't mean we should quit. That doesn't mean we should join in with that. We should respond as a godly person and not just give in to it. Let's pray. Our Father.